I'm Al Pitcher, and this is a session entitled, Why Community? A word about the background out of which I make some observations. 1939, I wrote a thesis at the University of Chicago on the religious idea of community in contemporary thought. And for about 15 years, I lived out of the philosophy of Alfred North Whitehead and Henry Nelson Wyman, with some Christian symbols and things thrown in, which was to set up the conditions for community to develop. The whole idea of Whitehead in process and reality, he was a famous English philosopher, was that the individual was no individual without community, and there was no community without the individual. And the point was to develop the individual in community. Being was the individual in community. Without community, you were not. So that the whole point of existence was to develop the individual in community. And one of the professors at the university, Hartshorne, developed the notion of the compound individual, that God was the individual that included all the individuals in community. So that insofar as you develop your individuality in community, you develop the body of God. At any rate, after some years of doing that, I met a couple of Niebuhrites, and they convinced me that I needed to do a little bit more. And so I came back to the university, and in the process I met Paul Tillich's analysis of the world situation, in which he said that we were at the end of the Protestant era. That is to say, we were at the end of the period in which the principle of self-initiation, whether it be in religion or in education or in political terms or in economics, had reached its zenith and was on the way down. And the world wars and communism and fascism were a response to the failure of the principle of self-initiation, what we call freedom. Freedom is self-initiation, to produce a life which could sustain life. So then I went to the university for a while and took a few years out trying to get a PhD and began to teach. And so those years are kind of blank in terms of community. I tried to create a little community in the Divinity School, but as some of you know, at universities and Divinity Schools, sometimes that's hard. At any rate, I came to Holden in 1972, and we began to come regularly then. And in 1976, we read Benjamin Zablocki's The Joyful Community, which is a story of the Bruderhof. And several of us decided to do something about taking Holden back into the cities. It was about that time also that I gave a lecture in one of my classes on Paul Tillich's theology, and it was a big course for all kinds of students. And it was on the ethical implications of the theology. And so I developed the what I call the ontology of Tillich, what he called the ontology. And out of that came what you call an intellectual decision. There are several kinds of decisions in life. And Holden kind of gave us an experience which made us want to move in the direction, both my wife and I think, in the direction of, I won't speak for her, individualization, participation. I can't think of that word. Anybody know Tillich's ontology? This is freedom, means everything is in flux, but I can't think of this word. At any rate, dynamics. These are polarities. And the other polarity is the what we call a profane, what Herbert Marcuse calls a one-dimensional existence, profane and the holy. So that you have a vertical dimension and you have these horizontal dimensions. And what Tillich said in essence was that Western civilization was going like this. It's not quite accurate, but it's going toward the profane and toward all of these polarities. And it's destructive. And you've got to move in the other direction. Or else life won't continue to exist. I mean, this is the structure of being. And if you don't have the right movements in history, the right mixes of these kinds of principles, the right kind of mix of reality, you will destroy yourself and the whole shebang. And the meaning of the holy is that whatever you do on the horizontal plane is seen in terms of the world and a world behind the world, so that all of the things that you experience in some sense are but mirrors of, they're related to a whole, and we call that God. That is, the whole civilization, Western civilization, not all civilization, but Western civilization, moving toward individualization and freedom as self-initiation. I'll be using this more, but I hit this. It just came to me when I was preparing this lecture that's really what's happening. So the participation, of course, community is over this side. And you put focus on the individual, focus on the community. And you can see from the structure, you really don't focus completely on either, or you destroy. But in terms of our history, we have moved so far this way that we're threatened with destruction. And so we need to move the other way. So I had the experiential basis for thinking that there was something meaningful in focusing on community. I had an intellectual background from Whitehead and Wyman, Hartshorne, and then Tillich suddenly opened up the whole world. Got to move. It doesn't matter how you feel about it, although feelings are crucial, but the world needs to move in this direction, or else it will be destroyed. And while I'm on this point, this is nature. And the whole ecological crisis is focused on our failure to take into account the destiny that nature is. It is a structured reality. We are not free to play just as we please. We have a measure of freedom, but life is always balancing that measure of freedom with the structures of being, without which attention to life in some way ceases. And that's what the ecologists are telling us today. We don't pay attention to this destiny. That's our destiny. I always used to say, well, it's your destiny to be a male or a female. Now we know it isn't quite our destiny. I mean, we got all kinds of ways we can change all kinds of things. So freedom is a slippery term, and destiny is slippery too. These are all slippery terms because, in a sense, you have to make your judgment in terms of where you think we are in history, where you want to place yourself, where it is that attention is needed. And from this, attention is needed in the holy. And on these dimensions, I put world down here too. It's a shorthand way I gave a talk the other day on beginning with God, and the first thing I said, to begin with God means to begin with the world. Of course, you always begin with yourself. You can't avoid it, but the question is, how long do you stay with yourself and your subjectivity and your feelings and all that thing? How long does it take you to get out to the world, to God's world, and the structures of the world, which are important for everything that anyone holds dear that I know. At any rate, then that gets me up to 77. I'm moving slowly. Sarah said I should make this talk fast. We're all tired. At any rate, then I went back to Chicago, and in 77 I became the Minister for Community Development at University Church. And we began a series of encounters, study Elizabeth O'Connor's book, The New Community. And in 79, we bought a 22-flat building, and we moved some people in, and it was in an all-black area, and many of the people didn't want to move. But slowly, most of them came along once they saw that we had a place to be and form community. So just before we came up here, in fact, we came up here a little late for Paul's school because we celebrated our 10th anniversary in that building, and we have 65 people in that community, and we've had that community for 12 years. We've had the building for 10, and we'll talk about that in one of these sessions. We'll really talk about the concrete problems of that, so that it's out of that, plus my years in the church, we began to build community with Central America. And we have all kinds of connections in our church with Central America. Unbelievable connections, like Dale and Nancy Jones, who are the assistants now to the Bishop, Bishop Gomez, the Lutheran bishop in El Salvador. We all came out of building connections, out of building what I call community. Community is connections. It's connections which are positive, which somehow enhance and support and sustain and bring more reality to people. And we've done some other things which we may talk about later. But what I want to get into today is that is to make the assertion that everything depends upon where you begin in life. Or to put it another way, how long you remain where you first begin, necessarily begin. Inevitably, we begin with ourselves as sensing, feeling, seeing organisms. The issue is, do we remain with ourselves, or do we at some point start beginning with God? Or to put it another way, do we stay with our phenomenal self, or do we dig down deep and start beginning with our created self, the image of God in us? And that's the key. Now, let me give you another. Uh-oh. Well, technology gets in the way of spontaneity here. At any rate, through the history of thought, you can really. It's a little oversimplified, but still, it's worth thinking about, I think. It helps explain the ontological, that's a big word, science of being. Phenomenal, and you can either start with the self or with the part, that's the individual, or you can start with a larger whole. Usually the sociologists start with the society, or you can start with an essential self, start with the individual, or you could start with an essential whole. This is Hobbes and most American political thought. It starts with the phenomenal self. Or this is Durkheim, Talcott Parsons, famous American sociologist. Or you can start with the essential self. That's Eric Fromm. There's a lot of psychology now that talks about an essential self. Or you can start with the essential whole. This is Plato, the Neoplatonists, Augustine, all the Christians that I know anything about. Start with the essential whole. To be a Christian, this is start with the essential whole, which we label God. There is an essentialness to the structure of being, to the whole of the world, which we seek, and in terms of which we find our life and have our meanings. We say, but our whole psychology of adjustment starts with the self as a part, for the most part. At any rate, I did want to say a little bit about habits of the heart. I'm now getting into the sociological interpretations of where we are. I've given you Tillich's interpretation, the theologian's interpretation of where we are, and now you go into the sociological interpretation of where we are, and habits of the heart is right here on the board. Habits of the heart says, this is what we have. This is what American life is. Its focus is on the individual. And it not only focuses upon the individual, it focuses upon what these authors, five authors, did 200 interviews of middle-class America. It focuses upon what they call, I can't remember this name, I call it instrumental. Utilitarian is the big word they use for them. They got to find words that confuse some of us. Utilitarian or instrumental. What that means is that what we focus upon is what is useful to us, to the self. What's useful? What's usable? Or expressive instrumentalism. Expressive instrumentalism means that you focus on how you feel. Well, it'll give you freedom to kind of express yourself and your feelings. That's what the book says. The book says, America is here. That's where the middle class is. It's right there. They say there is another tradition, a Republican Christian tradition, which talks about a city built upon a hill whose founder and maker is God, John Winthrop, and that tradition. There's a stratum of American life that still believes that sort of thing. But by and large, now you don't have to read this book. I mean, this is the book. It's the book. And they don't have much of an answer for it. In fact, they say what a teacher ought to do, the teacher should teach loves. That's what a teacher should do. I don't want to get started on education, because that's another matter. But, and then they say, at the end, when they're talking about their conclusion, perhaps, they say that 15 times, they will not admit that they have any convictions. That they really have any convictions. And of course, the social scientists, they say, most social scientists would say you're not supposed to have convictions. If you do, then everything is biased. But everybody does have convictions, because everybody that I've ever read has a worldview that fits pretty well into one of these categories. And that worldview influences what they say and what they see. And I can, I've got all kinds of analyses of political science which show that different authors see different reality in the 50s. There are three books, three different descriptions of what's going on in America, qua social science. At any rate, for modern Western persons, there is no other self or social reality except what is given, what is experienced, what is felt, what is participated in. We are driven by how we feel or the demands of the institutions which we have chosen to be a part of or happen to be a part of. Everything is seen in terms of its utility for our individual interests, feelings, or purposes. Fortunately, I've done that page. And that page. Sarah said I shouldn't read, so. I'm getting through this fast now. Now, I got to do one more thing. And I got to get it up here. I don't know which one is the most important to maintain. Maybe I can put it down here. And this is the interpretation of modernity. And this is the side of the traditional society, which in some people's terms is primitive, and I purposely call it traditional, because to call it traditional is not to negate it. And I'll run through this fairly rapidly. There are four general categories, and in the modern society you treat everybody in terms of the universal. The universalism, you treat people in terms of their universal characteristics. You go to the dentist for your teeth and the psychiatrist and somebody else for your toe and somebody else for your sink and somebody else for your carpentry work and you, somebody else to check you out at the counter in the store. I mean, you're a bunch of what I call abstract relations to people, just little segments of you. And what you do, you treat people in terms of some universal aspect, not the whole. And here you're treated as a particular individual. You are a whole person instead of being just a little bit of you that somebody can do something about. And here you achieve your status by achievement. Very interesting. With all our Lutheran justification by grace, we can participate so joyfully in an achievement culture in which all our statuses are given by our... You know, when you ask who people are, then they want to know, you know, what you've done to create this status, what you've achieved. I used to say I like to hear birds. I like to listen to them. Or paint pictures or something. That's still achievement, I guess. Anyway, two, you get it by ascription. That's to say, you're born into a family and you have status. I sometimes wonder about that. I think my second son had a distinct, distinction of flunking out of Oberlin twice. I don't know anybody else who's ever flunked out of Oberlin twice. You talk about whether his family accepts him because he's a part of the family. We have a hard time treating our children on the basis of a given status, regardless of anything they do or achieve. But that is part of an achievement of a traditional society. And here we have what these terms really get you, don't they? Affective neutrality. These are all Parsonian terms. But what that means is that you're a professional and you don't get emotionally involved with your clients, or you don't get emotionally involved with anybody else. And over here, I don't know what, I can't remember what his term is, but it's involvement, it's emotional involvement. I'll call it involvement emotionally. I just read a study, about a study, I didn't read a study, it was testimony before a House Select Committee, which Ms. Elizabeth Shore says that the only way you can really do anything for people who exist in families of long-term poverty is if you take three or four families, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and you do anything they need. And then there's some hope that something will happen. And then you put over against that the professional social worker who works from 9 to 5, and you know. Anyway, this involvement emotionally. Oh, and this has to do with the secularization. I've already alluded to this in Tillich's diagram, profanization or secularization. And here you have everything is holy. Everything in a sense is God in it. I mean, trees and animals and all kinds of things in a traditional society. Well, again, you know, the wave of the future, according to the Parsons, is modernity. And I say that's for the birds. There's no wave of the future in that direction, given what we have. There's some balance. So what I say about our community, and this is one of the reasons I'm introducing all this stuff, is that we are a mixture of modernity and traditionalism. And that's what we're trying to be in our community. We're trying to be. Because of values, we have one woman in our community who took 13 years to get a PhD in mathematics. She's teaching on the faculty. She's a brilliant woman. But she served our community. She wasn't focused on achievement, on her career, the way everything seems to be grinding up today. She had some other interests. And she spent a lot of time. She organized our 4-day weekend retreat, our 4-day celebration for 10 years. She organized that. This highly trained mathematics. She says that life is a struggle. Everybody else has nice homes, and, you know, big homes and all this stuff. And she's living with us in decent housing, but you know, with limits and all kinds of responsibilities. Anyway.
I'm really going fast.
So now I've got why community. Is there any question in your mind why I think community is important? I mean that this is a worldwide structural life and death issue. Well, I haven't got to the life and death part of it quite, because the question now is what kind of a community. Granted, all I've said about moving in this direction is important. What kind of a community? And that brings in the holy, and it brings in this destiny that we have community all the time. Every time you participate, every time you share with anybody, if there's any positive response and anything remains with you, you have community with that person. I often say to people, well, I'm hunting, I say, take a part of my being with you, and I'll take a part of yours. That's I know it doesn't help sometimes to verbalize something, but that's actually what we want to happen with people, frequently. We want whatever strengths and whatever reality we are to take over with them. It's especially if you're dealing with somebody who's got a little weakness, more weakness than you have, let me put it that way, more weakness, though in matter of degree. And we need all those hugs. Anyway, the question is, what kind of a community? And therefore, it's the purpose of the community that becomes important, and whether the community is just in order to get participation, or whether the community is to involve in that participation the holy, which means it involves the world, which means you have to take this dimension very seriously, particularly today. You have to take the ecological problem very seriously, but there are all kinds of other problems that one takes seriously if one is in the community in relationship to God, in relationship to the world, in relationship to the whole shebang. Then it makes the community different. Our covenant starts out, God having covenanted with us to be a people for all people, we covenant together to be such a people for all people. That's an audacious, outlandish, unrealistic statement. Again, the question in my mind is not exactly whether or not you can do all the things you think you can covenant to do, but the question is, can you move in the direction? There are directions which are required, I think, by our... And this is all, you know, this is Al Pitcher. As I said in one of my talks here before, I was reading, listening to my tape, I said... That this book, Habits of the Heart, is great. It agrees with me. So all of this is just where I am. It's what's happened to me and trying to struggle to be. And it's why I think community in which God is involved, and I mean structurally, I don't mean just in your personal existence. I mean that you begin with God's world and all the people, as Luther says. We serve all of the people. And there's no way to serve all of the people, but you move in that direction. So we moved in the direction in our church. And there are three or four people in our community who are very deeply involved. Sarah has been to Nicaragua and to Guatemala and is deeply involved in this activity with a couple of sanctuary families we had and all kinds of stuff. That you move in those directions. That you're called, you're impelled in your freedom. So as Plato said, you choose destiny. And as an interrupted life, Eddie Hillesum said, I accepted my destiny. The question is, what's the structure of destiny? And that's not obvious either, because nobody knows exactly. Nobody has the answer. Nobody knows exactly what it is that's required in order to bring hope and life to the whole of the created order. Nobody knows what to do, really, to bring about a change in our ecological predicted catastrophes, although they give you all kinds of programs and this, the other thing. But nobody knows exactly how serious it is. But one has to make a judgment and then act upon it. Well, I think I've said enough to indicate that I think community is a demand. It's not something I miss. I'm not lonely. God knows I'm not lonely. But it's a demand by God from those of us who are faithful. I think I had a nice closing here somewhere.
So, no blueprint, but there's a direction. So we move toward participation, toward form, toward destiny in the context of the whole, of the sacred, the holy, in the context of God's creation, Son, and Spirit. Amen. Do that fast enough, sir?
You left out a couple of things.
What did I leave out?
The Bible.
Oh, the Bible. Oh.
Corinthians.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we'll get to that on, we'll get to the, we'll get to 1 Corinthians and then, that stuff. That's the other thing, of course. And simple to put that in because the Bible.
Now don't say too much preaching on it.
The Bible came out of a traditional society, and the Bible has an organic image of existence. We are parts of each other, and Paul says it. I mean, we are parts of each other, and even though Dan, I may not quite agree on whether that refers to the whole creation, I found a lot more passages to Dan's than me last year. I got them all right down here. The Bible says we feel each other's feelings and we suffer with each other. There's an organic metaphor there. It says that underneath all this phenomenal stuff that we see, there is a holy unity in life. And I always say, well, look at the field of force. You talk about our phenomenal world. We don't see this field of force out here in which we exist, but it's here. And I say, when anything happens to anybody, it happens to us. Even though we don't know it, we don't feel it, but we cease. We suffer when anybody else suffers in the whole universe. That's an affirmation of faith. But I think it's right out of Paul. He says, well, you know, if you're in sin, then of course you're separated. There's a wall between you and other people and God and nature. But somehow, to the extent that you can get rid of this, whatever you call sin, of self-elevation, making yourself God, trying to be everything, get rid of that, then the image of God in you would emerge, and that image is an image of organic interrelatedness to life, which is completely denied by most of our modern social scientists and a lot of other people. Now, did I get the Bible in? I mean, it's so clearly a basis for our community. And this is only an explanation. I guess I began to use that Pauline metaphor when we started the community back in about 77. So what thinkest thou?
I appreciate the fact that I'm not going to have to read all those books now.
I always was a help to my students. I made them read them and see if they could get it, and then I told them. One student once said, well, why don't you just give it to us? It is strange how there's structures to books, though, which are underlying structures of thought. That's not my original. I learned that from a mentor, the most wonderful, most astute, sophisticated person I've ever met. He taught me to look for this
So I'm deeply indebted for his help. And my Heideggerian students, because I had a colleague who was a Heideggerian, said, oh, you've got all those categories. You force them on this stuff. It isn't there. It isn't there. It isn't there. So, you know, you take it with a grain of salt.
I guess I like to hear other people talking about all the different aspects, because I've noticed, or I've decided, I thought about so much why is community important to me, and I've sort of figured out in my mind that I need so much energy in my life to do what I want to do, and either I'm going to have to feed myself that energy somehow, or someone else is going to give me that energy somehow. And if I'm using my own energy to build myself up, to go out and do what I need to do, I have that much less energy to go out and do what I want to do. Whereas if I know that's coming from the other people around me, very intentionally, I have that extra energy to go out. I don't know if that makes it, you know.
Yes, that makes sense.
Well,
it's really, I started thinking through this just a few months ago, because I noticed, I was becoming aware that on the days that we had our OSMT, our peacemaking fellowship, were the days that I came home feeling the most tired, and it's like, I don't want to go to this, I don't have the energy to go to this group. So I started paying attention, why is that? You know, it's not that I don't want to go to the group, because I come back feeling twice as good as when I went. And I started to pay attention and realize those are the days that I was giving so much energy to my work situation or wherever I was, and I don't think that's an accident. And I think that I wasn't conscious I was doing it, but I knew I was going to get more energy that night. You know, I knew.
But it does take a lot
there.
Of energy to build a community.
Oh sure. Oh sure. I mean, that's part. I guess I see that as part
and
of the work.
You have to say no to a lot of things if you're going to.
Sure.
I mean, it's clear everybody that I've been reading about community says you gotta, if you don't know how to be alone, and not just alone, but with real solitude, recreative solitude, you'll have a problem being in community. That there's a dialectic.
Well, it's a balance.
Yeah. So I've started not coming to breakfast, and I use that time now to read Romans, or write a letter or do something that's I'm just not going to spend all my time relating to people. I gotta recreate myself, and you know, it's always it's so much a question. And of course Bonhoeffer says, well, you're always got to be available, you got to give up your plans and everything else for the community. You know, it's like our simulation exercise. We're going to give up anything to take that person in, whether or not that person's going to kill us all. You know, it's there is some calculation in my existence. I'm not talking about anybody else's existence. Calculation about what will fit together and make a good day and a good balance. And Sarah will say, I go out too much. And I remember Tillich saying, go out too much, you kill yourself. Stay home too much, you kill yourself. It's a balance. It was when he uses these illustrations of individualization participation. You have to have time to integrate what you've experienced so that it becomes a real part of you. I can go to a movie and I come home and I haven't got anything left the next day or so. Sarah goes to the movie, you know, there are different kinds of memories and so forth, but I don't pay any attention to the movie after I get home. And I don't think about it any other time, so I don't have anything left. So in a sense, what's the use of the experience if you've just had a little bit of emotion and you don't really integrate an experience into your being? And that takes energy and time and attention. So now when I can't sleep at night, sometimes I think about everybody in the community and try to think about what they need, what I might do, and if I do nothing else but hold them in my mind for a while. I have one woman who's got cancer. She's not in my community at all. She's church I used to. I was in another church for 22 years. Worked 22 years in church. Did everything I did in this church, and nothing happened. Nobody missed me when I left. And nothing was left in the way of institutions in this present church. Everything is there. You can't believe what's there. And I work 10 hours a week, more or less, 9 months of the year. And things, you know, God does it. Let's believe it. God does it. Some things, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But you still have to try. Be present. But I think every community needs some pretty healthy individuals with some with a kind of deep faith that we all need things, but where the needs are much less than ordinary. So that the community, I was saying today, I think every community needs some people who say, I'm in it for life. Yeah, of course, there are all kinds of different. I really want to read all your papers. I wished I had them before I talked tonight so I could somehow respond to individuals, because this is just thrown out, you know. That's not the way to teach or preach or do anything. I do know Carla's toes.
He wanted my toes for me today.
Yeah. Well, in terms of the movement in our society to privatism and the cranking up of the competitive nature of our society, and this individualization as you talked about it, what visions do you have for what can turn that around? Make it get back more in balance? Will it just burn itself out? What appeals? I mean, right now we live in a society that seeks affluence so it can purchase individualization. And that's the reason for affluence. The more affluence, the more individualization. So our society.
Well, yes and no. Not necessarily the more individualization, but the more things, certainly, the more. I'm not sure whether we're producing what I call healthy individuals. And If you've got all kinds of complexes and things, and you've got all kinds of dissatisfactions and frustrations, you're not a very strong person. And so that I follow these analyses, and I don't have a lot of clinical evidence for this, although I think it's there. And it's anyway, that's not your point. The point is, what do we do about all this? I don't know what to do about it. That's why I'm in hold. I hope somebody will give me the answer. No, that's not it. I never wait for people to give me the answer. But we've been reading A Parting of the Waters by Taylor Branch, story of the King days, and you can't believe what happened because of that one person. It's just almost impossible to believe what was going on. But of course, all kinds of other individuals somehow were energized to do all sorts of things. And I think we need a kind of a religious movement, and you can't produce it. You know, you can't produce this. We need some people who embody something new, who are become heroes. We don't have a single person in national life that's very enticing, do we? It really is the embodiment of being, and of hope, and of charity, and of compassion, and of sensitivity, and of philosophical training so they can deal with issues on a broad basis instead of ideologies. You know, it's clear. You got socialism and communism up here too. And you've got capitalism over here, and you got socialism over here. Very simple. And some combination of the two that you need. You've got an ideological split in this country, and we've got a friend who's a socialist, and he's just as ideological as the capitalist. And so that doesn't help any, and we've seen what's happened in China and Russia. They're all moving back this way. For a long time, we said, they're of the devil. And all they were was a response to the inability of our principles to work in the world. That's all Marx was. And he pushed over and said, well, you've got to have more participation, more willingness to give up your freedom of self-initiation for the sake of the whole, more willingness to give up, to participate in a nation that has some direction from the center, and those nations that went all the way over here are now coming back. I mean, it's perfect illustration that life demands somehow both principles, but neither one in the extreme and ideological, so it cannot be seen the values of the other. I just puke when I hear people talk about the values of the American nation as over against the values of the socialist nations. You know, China is one of the few nations in the world that has stopped its population growth. Now, you may not like the way they stopped it, but the future of the world is just different because they stopped it. In India, they predict, they got 817 million people now. They predict before they level off, there'll be twice that, 1,600 million, 1,600,000,000. China was in the same direction. Now they've leveled off. Nothing could be more important for the history of the world than for the third world nations to level off in their population development. The prediction is that Mexico, if it keeps its population growth, will be pounding at our... We haven't seen anything to what will be the influx of people. We will build a wall between us and Mexico in the next 50 years if they don't stop their population growth. Because they don't have the resources to support them. They're gathering in the cities, shanty towns, and so forth. And who was it was telling us of people who come up here and, you know, all kinds of people. Well, it was Selby. Where's Selby? He isn't here. Telling us people he was picking apples with. And send their checks back. And, of course, we want that. But the pressure is going to be... We'll have armed camps, and as this prediction is, we'll put them in camps and they'll starve in the camps. So, you say, you know, that it's, the system is awful, it's demonic, and yet it's the one, China is one of the few systems in the world, some of the Scandinavian countries are doing pretty well, some of this, one of the few nations in the world that's really tried to deal. They give privileges to people who have one child. They give special priorities for schooling. They give money. They give housing. They appeal, in other words, to the principle of self-initiation by rewards. But it's a national determination and an action by the government, and not just leaving it to the free will of individuals. Anyway, get me off on that one. That's the second greatest problem. Third greatest problem in the world, I think, is the inability to understand the meaning of the whole Marxist movement as a response to the failure of the capitalist movement, and that the dialectic has to continue. If we give it time, and it probably will continue without our intervention. Now, what do we do to shift the whole spiritual basis for our culture? I don't know. If we would force the rest of the world, or allow the rest of the world, or make it possible for the rest of the world to have our standard of living, we would make it impossible for anybody to live, I believe, on this planet, by virtue of the warming effect, and by virtue of the ozone depletion that would occur, unless somehow our whole productive enterprise shifts so radically that it's all renewable energy sources. We don't use practically no more coal and no more oil. And I don't know how we're going to industrialize without the use of the fossil fuels. But the story, the predictions on the fossil fuels, again, it might be wrong, but I think it's right enough to be aware of the fact that the American way of life is not universalizable under present conditions. And it's a good Kantian principle, and I'm not a Kantian in any sense of the word, because I don't believe that you absolutize form, which is what I think Kant did, because I don't know whether that's right or not. But you don't have an absolute form ever that life, but so you move from one kind of society and one kind of way of dealing with a problem, one form of social organization or one form of organizing life, but there's still some forms that are fairly stable. You can't just keep everything changing completely, because there are forms which have a kind of eternal relevance. For Plato, there were forms. Form was dominant. For the Neoplatonists, said God was free, he could use whatever forms he wanted. But still, he bound himself to certain forms, to a law. He pretty much bound himself to the law, some laws of creation, and we need to try to ferret these out. Of course, we don't have any law for today, really. We don't know what we should be about in terms of the ecological issues, what we should be doing. Somebody said, why should you have kids when the rest of the world can't have kids? I don't know. You know, you're really getting into, you ask what we should do. Pray about it, that's your. I think that a reformation is possible. But you can't predict it and you can't cause it. You know, Martin Luther emerged in response to a situation. I think we are in a critical world situation today, and we need a Luther. I mean, we need somebody to penetrate this in terms of its spiritual meaning, that we're called upon to a different way of being as a nation, certainly as a people of God. And I don't know the exact form of that. By the end of the year, and by June, I got some ideas. Or something happens, I'm struck by lightning, or something. You know, who knows? But is that right? I mean, we need a kind of a reformation of our existence. And what is involved, I think, is attention to the law. To write a new law for our day on the basis of what nature is telling us. And that's a big job. That's what Barney's coming up here to talk about, right? Isn't it? I mean, what Jerry Barney is coming up here from the 3rd to the 17th to talk about is the substance of the law for the Christians for the next millennium. I couldn't agree more with his projection of what we need. Now, we need a lot of other things. Gosh, we need a lot of other things. You know, we've got drugs, and we've got lonely people, and we've got messed up people, and we've got alcoholics, and we've got poverty. Poverty is increasing everywhere. Sexism, homophobia, racism, got all kinds of other issues to attend to, and so I say somewhere, I don't know whether I say it here, but I may have said it in my sermon, that the fact that I go on the ecological issue, that's only a month old. If you know my enthusiasm, you know, I get them and I get them. But I perceive it now as a key, as a door. What you try to find is a door. Central America was a door for us in our church into the problems of American culture and misunderstanding the relationship between socialism and communism. So we now have a group working on the relationship of the U.S. to the USSR, and a few people have gone to Russia, and a woman has written a position paper, and I hope to, I recommend her to come up here. She's just a lay person, she was a professor, but she just took, this issue hit her suddenly, finally. That's what's emerged in our church. People are hit by these issues, and suddenly they take them upon themselves and begin to run with them, and they've done all kinds of things. But that's nascent. Central America, you know, it opened up the major issue for all kinds of people, but not for very many. That's the problem. But the spiritual issue, I think the spiritual issue is the key. You see, it's a value problem. It's a being problem. And there are all kinds of intellectual issues and all kinds of understandings that are important and that help. But people have to be moved, convicted. Don't we have a saying in the evangelical wing, at least, about being convicted of one's sin? And we live in sin. Insofar as we're separated from nature. Just read an article which said, the end of nature. We have so devastated nature that it's no longer dependable as one of the constituting forces of our being. We can't depend on it anymore, insofar as we could depend on it. If you're a farmer, I guess you wouldn't think you could depend on it completely, but still. It was a kind of destiny that was there, and you didn't worry about the fact that life would be impossible or that deserts would emerge. One third of the earth is now threatened with becoming deserts in the next 30, 40 years. 4 billion 500 million acres.